Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where I and Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin baffle you with our wisdom every week.
Baffle.
And we baffle them. We entertain, obviously. That's what we've got to do. I mean, I would say we are strongly in that, close to being the, what's his name? Was the MMA fighter and the comedian?
I think I'm not sure.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
He's got a podcast. Why am I forgetting his name?
Oh, I don't know.
He's got the podcast.
Joe Rogan?
Joe Rogan. We're like the Rogan. We're the Joe Rogan of the nuclear podcast world.
I'm not sure Joe would want to.
I think we just crossed the copyright infringement of something.
Joe, please don't sue us. We don't know that for sure.
Send us your listeners, please. Send us your listener list.
Yeah. So, you know, as usual, you know, we're out there reading and thinking and doing stuff like that. And there was an article a day or two ago in The Hill, America Isn't Prepared for a Strike Against Our Nuclear Weapons, by Ben Oleren Shaw, who is a freelance journalist, I think. And, you know, there are some things about the piece that, you know, I'm kind of empathetic with, but it's my problem with the article was that it was just factually not accurate, because the basic argument that is in the article is that, well, we don't have looking glass on airborne alert anymore, and we've got hypersonic weapons and drones, and because of them, our ground alert, looking glass / TACAMO, but you know, we've got them on ground alert, and therefore they can be wiped out. And if they're wiped out for whatever reason, then we can't launch nuclear weapons, which is absolutely not the case.
I would never have thought of all those things happening to us. Oh, we should go run to the hills.
Yeah. So, I mean, the disappointing part of it was, you know, I might agree. I like airborne alert. I've always been a big fan. We want to put bombers back on alert. That's one of the things we would like to see done. So I would like to spend more money on nuclear modernization and expansion. So, you know, I'm sort of empathetic there, but I still think you have to get, you know, sort of your facts straight. And so by sort of, at least to me, it came off in the article with, looking glass will get wiped out in the first strike and therefore we can't launch, which is in no way anywhere close to being accurate. Now, I thought, you know, I know this guy who used to fly looking glass and is pretty familiar with the NC3 mission, and his name is one Curtis Scooter McGiffin.
Scooter!
And so I'm going to turn
it
over.
Not a call sign I've ever had.
So I'm going to turn that over to you, Curtis, and ask you, can you maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the Looking Glass mission and just sort of, we have backups, you know, because Looking Glass was a backup. It reflected our terrestrial, you know, capabilities, and that's why it was called Looking Glass. And then there were backups to backups. Can you kind of help us out here?
Well, sure, Adam. Thanks. It's good to see you. Thanks for that. And Jim, thanks for being here as always. I would say that, all right, so I flew the Looking Glass in the 1990s after it had finished its continuous airborne alert for, some 30-some-odd years. We do have a NIDS Nuke Knowledge podcast where we talk about this, and you can encourage our listeners and viewers to go back and find that on our website. But the reality here is that the Looking Glass, all through the Cold War, I think since about 1961 to about 1990, flew 24/7, 365. always was a jet in the air with a general officer on bar on board, and the codes and the capabilities to not only launch nuclear weapons if necessary, but to ensure what we call the PACS, the post-attack command and control. How would you bring aircraft back from, you know, to sort of land them somewhere safe, reload them, and turn them for another strike? You know, this is sort of Cold War SACism kind of stuff. And the alert jets and there were about 31 of these jets at its high point in the Cold War, these EC-135s, a version of the tanker. It was just like the KC-135 tanker, except it also had a receptacle to receive gas, so it could stay airborne for a long time, as long as basically the life of the oil in the engine. And until the toilets overflowed, right? So you're always limited by those two things. And so that was essentially how that worked. And there was even a way that if you couldn't get tankers to support and keep the airborne that way, that you could bring a B-52 in and connect the boom of the EC-135, and you could what they called reverse air refueling, and they could suck gas out of the B-52 in order to keep the looking glass flying. That's how important this mission was. During the Cold War, it was, Adam, America's dead hand during the Cold War. That if all of the other command posts and command centers were destroyed, this airborne asset would still be able to ensure that whatever weapons survived would be able to launch and execute that retaliatory threat. That is essentially the essence of deterrence. So you had these situations after 1990. It went to ground alert status, and then they would fly an active looking glass jet once a day, 7 days a week, and they would do it rotating times, classified times, you know, sort of mixing it up so the adversary couldn't predict when the jet might be up. And then eventually, as the 90s progressed and we felt safer and safer and the peace dividend getting larger and larger, we just went to work in business hours and we flew the looking glass 5 days a week. But there was always an alert jet out there until the mission was finally retired, I think in about 1996 with the EC-135, and was replaced with the new E-6 TACAMO, which was a modern, at the time, 707 airframe that the Navy was using to do its TACAMO mission to support the nuclear submarines. And so they had a rotational system where they would do ABINCAP missions, which is what they renamed the Looking Glass to. And then when they were done doing that for a couple of weeks, they would go and do their TACAMO missions on whichever coast they were assigned to, and then eventually work their way back to home. And so things changed. The jet, the E-6 is a was a heavier jet. So there were fewer people, a lot more equipment, and these sorts of things. And it had a very low room for swap, right? And how much, if you needed to add weight, you were going to have to take weight off. I mean, it was a heavy jet. And that jet carried on this mission in some form and version now since then, since 1996. And here we are, approaching 2026, and there are plans now, right, to replace these jets with something called the SAOC, or the Survivable Airborne Command, Airborne Operations Center, I think, which is sort of a playoff where we're going to have the TACAMO and the Looking Glass, and maybe even the NAOC, the National Airborne Operations Center, which is the hat I'm wearing. I also flew those, and all sort of in one jet, and so. I think the TACAMO mission is going to be something different, and it's going to be separated back out in some sort of C-130 model, which is what it used to be. And so you know, kind of we see a lot of going back to the future in the way that we're organizing these mission sets. But to the credit of nuclear modernization today, Adam, we still see the importance of this. And so there's new efforts to build these new airplanes and making sure that they can accomplish all of these missions. The question now comes down to, and when we think about Ben's article, is do we have enough? And I think he's trying to advocate that we should go back to continuous airborne operations in order to ensure that we can survive these new compressing attack times with modern technology and hypersonics and these sorts of things. It is a good question to ask. And the answer is, can we do it? Yes, if it's a priority. And so you can do it given enough crews, enough jets, enough maintenance, enough money, and enough commitment. And that's the only thing, there's a lot of things, but that's the only thing that's holding us from doing it.
Yeah, my only problem, though, and maybe you could speak to this, Jim, is I don't necessarily know that you have to have a jet to do it. Given the technology that we've got, and really because all you need is secure comms. And secure comms, there's secure comms we can't talk about on this podcast that are many alternatives. And that's one thing that sort of irritated me about the article was the implication that without, you know, the E6B, there's no, you know, there's no way to launch weapons. And there's many ways to launch weapons, many ways, terrestrial, there's all kinds of ways. And so I don't want to give the American people the impression that we're in a situation that we're not in. And so to me, part of what my question would be is, do we really need jets anymore? Or maybe we need some, but maybe there are very small digital systems that can be terrestrially based and dispersed. Maybe they're mobile. You know, maybe they're, you know, we don't need it like Cheyenne Mountain right now. Like Cheyenne Mountain is not the facility that it was designed to be by Eisenhower because, you know, technology's changed that. And that's probably okay. You probably don't need it to be what it once was because there's other ways you can do that and accomplish that mission. And so that's part of, you know, my kind of heartburn was just, hey, it's not the bleak situation you're saying. And you know, I'm not that worried about, you know, hypersonics, just destroying, you know, Tacoma sitting on the tarmac and, you know, it off it. And then we're just SOL. That's not the situation we're in. Jim.
Thank you for turning this over to me, Adam. First of all, I've never flown on the NAOC, so I want the audience to understand I don't speak from that expertise level. But if you want my unabashed opinions coming from an Army guy, continuous airborne alert, I agree. Bombers 24/7, I agree. Artillery rounds delivered by with nuclear weapons, I agree. That last one was just gratuitous, not related to this article at all. But I throw all those together. So I agree with all those. Let me first, Adam, pick this apart related to the, you know, airborne alert. I think it's obviously a continuous airborne alert keeps us from having a static target for a surprise attack. That's probably a useful insight that miraculously was discovered by this article writer in the writing here. I was so surprised, never thought of it. I also think there are some secondary things about having airborne alert and also bombers on alert that I think are worth mentioning. And now we'll talk about the communication issue. But I do think keeping our fleet in focus and our airmen trained in doing these operations is very important for the leadership, for the airmen, for the support organizations that operate these aircraft If by flying them 24/7, you have a different attention to them. Curtis lived those years. You know how important and how focused they were. Yeah, they put a big demand on our airmen, but it also gave them a sense of accomplishment and gratitude and understanding how that operation worked. I think that's really important. I think it's viable if we have enough aircraft. I think it puts the onus back on Congress to see why the number of aircraft we have and need are important. So having them in the air, having them visible, having an option to see all that, I think is really important. It worked during the Cold War. I mean, we're all here. I don't remember any nuclear wars happening since, ever for two nuclear states. So it worked. And then I'd also say that, I'm a big into training, and training is fundamental to successful operations. The fact that we're training as we're going to operate is important. So, yes, that's an important aspect of this. But I will also say this is not the only way to skin the cat. Since the 1960s, we've got extremely valuable space assets that can be used for communication. We have ground assets that we can communicate both line of sight and now not line of sight. We're looking on quantum communication capabilities. Those quantum communication capabilities allow us to communicate quickly and securely when our adversaries shorten our timeline. Originally built for longer periods, now possibly 15 minutes, you say, with hypersonics, or as the author of this said, a drone attack against a couple aircraft on the ground, which I thought was a rather interesting but not well thought out argument.
The Ukrainians did do that against Russian bombers. So it is, it's a legitimate concern
We are so, Russia. And last I looked at, there's a lot of distance between Russia and the United States versus Ukraine and Russia. But, that's, I think, a big part of this. Unless you had a surprise, when you talk about surprises, if you start to go down the rabbit hole with any surprise that can happen, anything is possible. So we have alternate and, when you talk about survivable versus resilient, we are building survivable systems, but we are resilient by having alternate methods for overcoming the communication breaks in communication to just one aircraft or a couple aircraft, according to this article, which is just absolutely nonsense. We have multiple ways in which to communicate the command and control of our nuclear forces beyond just the aircraft in the air. I'll turn it back to Curtis because I see he's just biting his lip ready to say something. So, Curtis, I know, again, coming from me, the non-expert, hit me up.
No, this is awesome. I think what's important is to take a step back, and Adam, I think you'll agree here, as I would say, first is to understand, what is the role of NC3 when we think about nuclear deterrence and our posture for it, right? And that is that the adversary must believe that they cannot sever the ability for senior leaders to give that final order to launch weapons in retaliation. And it's much easier, because it's fewer targets, to target the command and control nodes than it is to target, all 400, some odd missile silos out there in the country, and trying to find the submarines, and don't forget where the bombers might be, and these sorts of things. Those are a lot more target sets, and so anytime you can allow the enemy to focus target on our command nodes, that's an issue. And right, wrong, or indifferent, this is a command node, right? And so we have to consider that. To the idea that there are many different ways, that's true, but I think few of us would argue that the risk to the loss of space-based communications is real and would probably come soon if a conflict were starting. It's quite possible that the loss of our space-based assets would be a precursor to a potential nuclear attack should that come. And the beauty of having an airframe that can be airborne and fly around is the ability to have that line of sight communication from high altitude downward. And so that has some value when we're thinking about commanding and controlling our nuclear forces. To Adam's point, why do we need jets? Maybe we could do it with maybe propeller airplanes or balloons or these sorts of things. And the answer is quite possibly. But you need speed. A speed is life, and you need speed for two reasons. One, if you're going to have a ground alert, you have to have the capability to get out of town as fast as possible. And 100 knots, 200 knots difference in speed at low altitude could be a difference between life and death when you're climbing away with minimal warning before impact. Secondly, you've got to travel vast distances in the shortest amount of time if you are going to execute direct launch capabilities and these sorts of things. And you don't want to be puttering along waiting for the wind or feathering the props as you get there. You need to be able to turn on the jets and get to these locations as fast as you can to hide and survive, to move code, and to be able to direct forces. And so there's value to having that ability to move around quickly. And the last thing I'll mention here in the value of an airborne alert or an airborne, even just a ground alert capability, is it's visible messaging to the adversary who knows where it is watching and all that. And people say, well, that's terrible. They'll know where to find it. Yes, but in the world of deterrence, you need to be visible. They need to see it. That is an important part of signaling and messaging the deterrent risk to them. That this capability exists, that you won't be able to knock it out, and it will make sure that the retaliation occurs. And so if you can get to the point where you accept that, believe in it, then you might decide, yet not today. Yeah. And that's the whole point.
Curtis, you mentioned the space warfare that may occur prior to a full-scale war. I don't disagree with that. That certainly is a viable option. But my point, and I'm just curious from your standpoint, my point is sort of the Curtis McGiffin whack-a-mole theory, where you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to do that. It won't be a surprise attack if space comes down. If our space assets go away, it's no longer a surprise attack. Okay, I mean, at least on the ground forces, well, in the air,
you'll have lost strategic surprise. Yes. That's for sure. But tactical surprise still extends, right? Yep. And so maybe to bring this article back in here, Ben's thesis is that America's ability to sort of destroy Iran's nuclear capability, and he says in here, without the element of surprise. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's error number one here. There was plenty of element of surprise tactically. They may have thought it's coming, but they didn't know when it's coming. And then they weren't able to detect that it's coming. And then when it was happening, they didn't know what was happening. And then to add insult to injury, when they left the airspace, they didn't know that either. And so this goes to just how tough it is in this regard. The element of surprise manifests in many different ways. And I would say, even though you might lose the space-based assets which would be a precursor warning, you've also lost your real telemetry warning, your ability to correlate and to see anything to know that it's actually coming. And so then you don't know. And that's all the more reason that you may want to put those jets in the air rather than having them sit on the ground. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Adam, where am I wrong here?
Well, I guess the thing that I was trying to point out was just that it doesn't, with the development of technology, it's sort of like when we complain about, hey, we're replacing Cold War era nuclear systems with just the newest version. So my only premise is, are we doing the same thing with, like, SEOP? I mean, is SEOP just basically saying, hey, well, this will be a newer, better, more technologically up-to-date version of a Cold War system? Maybe my premise isn't to put it on a you know, on a balloon or anything like that. I don't know that it has to be on the, you know, in the air at all, because, you know, for what used to take an aircraft full of equipment, can I have a, you know, a cargo van full of equipment with three dudes in the back? And can I have 14 of them driving around remote parts of the United States and in vans that look just like normal? You know, maybe we put, you know, Spiffy's plumbing on the side of them and they just drive around.
Away, Adam.
Yeah. I mean, think about all the things that we could do very differently and much, much less expensive. I can want 14 Spiffy's plumbing vans loaded with all the best, you know, secure comm equipment that'll allow us to do everything we need to do. You know, that's still cheaper than one, you know, than one jet. That's going to be a lot cheaper than one jet.
Yeah. So I understand where you're coming from, and I don't disagree that there aren't other ways to do this. And I have two reactions to that. The first one, I'll go to the second one first. And that is the idea that we can send out small vans of a handful of people. You're talking about tremendous amounts of launch information, and it's difficult. You got to secure it in such a way that would be difficult to do. If any one of those got compromised, you know, it would be a problem for the entire system, and so that's a big risk. Now, you might be able to do it in multiple, you know, caravans of vehicles, and there's been versions of that done in the past. To go to your point on, is the SAOC just sort of a modern version of a Cold War relic? And I would say, well, that is to say that the automobile, despite an electric powered vehicle being a new way to power it, it still has the same four wheels. We didn't make it six wheels because it's a smoother ride and a more agile system. It's still the same basic design. It just has a better engine and a much more cooler transmission system and an entertainment system and a guidance system. And that's essentially what we're doing with airplanes. We modernize airplanes all the time because we have yet to perfect teleportation. So we have to continue to utilize the technology and platforms that we can, but we can make them better. We can make them more modern. And I think this is where it goes. And I also want to caution our listeners and viewers that just because we did it in the Cold War doesn't mean it's not appropriate for today.
Right.
We are seeing a Cold War that is quite similar. Now, you call me a nuclear romantic if you want to, but when you look at it in its very macro sense, what did we have? We had great power competition between the United States and the Soviet Union, and then there was a lesser known power called China. And what do we have today? We have a great power competition between the United States and China and a lesser known power called Russia. However, that lesser known power has a crap ton of nuclear weapons, which the China lesser known in the 60s didn't have those, or not many of them. And so we have to understand that it's actually similar but same. As I used to say in my youth, same smell, different nostril. And so we have to understand that the way the world is. And so when we look at that, sometimes the right answer to deal with some of these problems is still sort of what we did before. And I mean, let's look at it, Adam. What's our modernization? New submarines, new ICBMs, new bombers. Sounds like Cold War to me. So I don't see how adding a SAOC isn't any different.
Well, my premise is just that, you know, we can, with what, you know, when Jim was, you know, using computers, it was vacuum tubes. It was the size. It was the size of a house.
Bailing wire.
It was the size of a house. Whereas with this right here, I've got, 10, 15 times more computing power than what was on the space shuttle?
Right.
I mean, things are a lot smaller. So my premise is just, I'm not saying the mission itself isn't needed. Secure comms. You've got to have secure comms.
Right, right.
But how we do secure comms, we might could do it a lot differently than we did during the Cold War. So it's not that I don't want to be able to break things and blow stuff up and kill people. My only premise is if we were to start from scratch, how would we design it? And would we put secure comms in the air? Would we build, you know, like we wouldn't build Cheyenne Mountain now. We would do something different. And so, you know, what would we, if we were doing it now and we could do whatever we wanted, how would we do it? And what would be the most cost effective and you know, effective way to do it? And that's all I'm asking. And maybe SAOC is what you need. Maybe you got to have it airborne, or maybe they're going to build capabilities that take, you know, drones that'll take out, you know, a SAOC, a NAOC, right. A TACAMO. So maybe that'll be the more dangerous way to do it because, you know, of drones. And so you got to blend in or you got to be underground. Who knows?
Well, I do think a variety of options is there. You know, certainly doing what we did in the Cold War, as Curtis is saying, you know, brings back, you know, an ability to the table that gives the adversary pause, that provides strategic messaging, all these things. I think, you know, as I think I said it in the last podcast, and, you know, people can listen last week, but I said, you have a dynamic adversary. You can't be static. So you must continuously rebuild, relook, innovate, so that you have options on the table, so that they're chasing your options instead of you chasing their options. And so that's what we need to do. And so this article somewhat brings that out by saying, oh, the sky is falling. We have one option. And the answer is no, we have many options, as you pointed out, Adam, because we've modernized, we have modern technology, we know our adversaries, we have better intelligence, we have capabilities. You know, cyber is so much better than it used to be. I would say the only argument I would have is your computer size may be different than mine, but I'm going to tell you, it's not size that matters. It's how you use it. And remember,
it's not the size, it's the motion of your phone. Let me add to this and say, or just remind. So, you know, in the 1970s, the Soviet Union spent percentages of GDP building underground, you know, survivable caves and tunnels and whatnot.
Yeah.
And the U.S. chose to use redundancy as its way of ensuring that its mission survived. The difference, though, is that if you're sitting in a hidey hole or inside of a mountain, the chances of you actually surviving are pretty great. If your strategy is built on redundancy, then what we're saying is it's okay if you die as long as the mission is transferred to someone else. Yeah. And so what I'm concerned about is I don't want everybody to die in a redundancy issue. I want actually for us to survive and then maintain resilience and redundancy after that. How do you endure? And so the challenge here is that we must think about how we are going to endure and reconstitute, not just have that redundancy where we delegate and transfer the mission from one dying platform or one dying node to another in order to ensure there's value in that. Don't get me wrong, but I think that that is the case. And you're right. As technology has made things smaller and lighter, there's not, you know, a real need for a large or platforms. In comparison, you know, one of the things in the old EC-135, it could only carry so much weight. And back then, technology, they had these giant plasma screens and they were super heavy. And, you know, you had, you know, EMP hardened telephones and all of this metal. And so the airplane was incredibly heavy. And as I mentioned already, the TACAMO was so heavy that it didn't have a whole lot of weight to adjust for new things that you, well, if you're going to add something new, you had to take something old off. And now you look at the E4 today compared to what the E4 was 20, 25 years ago. I would imagine it's much lighter because a lot of the systems that were built there have been removed and exchanged for small laptops and even some sort of iPad. And so the weight has definitely come down, and when you have less weight, you now can add more mission. You can put more people on there to get more accomplished if that's what's necessary, or to increase resilience and these sorts of things. And that all matters. And if you go smaller, then you have less ability to adapt to more mission and be able to be flexible as the mission changes, because you're only going to be focused on that core thing. And if that's not what's going on, I'm not able to really handle it. And so that's something that I would be concerned about. But as we go, as we look at the mission, and as we look at Ben's, I admire his passion and his cause, but his arguments leave a little, and that is that we have to decide as a nation, how important is visible deterrence and the guarantee of that second strike, the ability to withstand the first strike and get the remaining survivable capability launched afterwards to fulfill the promise, right, of retaliation. And if the moment the adversary believes that they can get away with it, then you're one step closer to them thinking first strike is the way to go. And that is the ultimate goal of Looking Glass and survivable command centers, whether they're plumbing vans or 747s and everything in between. There was a time when we had ships that did this business, by the way, that all of these things mean that it is too hard to stop the orders from going. And that is a deterrent message. That is a threat that our adversaries have to calculate on. And so we must embrace that, not disregard it. Not that we're doing that, but as a nation, so that we can embrace it. It's part of the modernization that is going on. As you say, you can't just buy a new new car and not change out the seat belts that are inside it that keep you safe, or update the software in the navigation and radio system. Entertainment system, those have to be updated too, or the vehicle's worth much less. It's much less valuable to you on a day-to-day basis. The NC3 and the Greater Nuke Enterprise and the modernization is the same thing. We mustn't try to upgrade all of the offense and never focus on the different ways that we are going to do in the command and control. And even though we're spending money on the command and control modernization, we mustn't forget the different ways that we need to operationalize that command and control. That's what matters here.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so I'll go ahead and leave it there. Of course, Jim, Curtis, thanks again for another great discussion.
Thanks for hosting, Adam.
Oh, yeah. And thanks to the listeners for being here and for listening to the show. Remind yourselves every morning as you get up and you have your coffee, I'm going to go to globalsecurityreview.com and check out the latest article. And, these podcasts, our podcast, Deterrence Down Under, Real Space Strategies, mm-hmm. they now show up That's on right. Global Security Review. Yep. So if you're not listening, on the RSS feed or wherever, you can find them on, I think they come out on Tuesday and Friday, I think. So that they're there, and then of course we've got the Truman Library event coming up August the 6th. So if you're in the Kansas City area, go to our website, sign up, and come down to the Truman Library for a 1-day event.
It's free, right?
It's a free event. We're going to have the archivist from the Truman Library is going to talk about why President Truman dropped the bomb, what was his rationale, what made him decide to do it. We've got General Paul Tibbetts, who's going to be there. He's going to talk about how his grandfather, who was the pilot that dropped the bomb on that day 80 years ago, he's going to talk about that. We've got General Imbum Chun, who is a retired Korean general, talking about why it's really important for the United States to have extended deterrence. I'm going to talk about how cheap nuclear weapons are.
There you go.
And
inexpensive, not cheap.
Inexpensive, inexpensive.
And they're not cheap. They're
for you, very good price, my friend. Very good price.
Very good price.
I will have the wing commander or deputy wing commander from the 509th is going to come. And it's going to be a great day. So that's coming up. We've got the Husey events. They're on the Think Deterrence website. There's tons of stuff going on. All you got to do is just go check it out. Sign up, listen, watch, read, and we promise you, you'll enjoy it. It's a money back guarantee.
I will be there as well. And so come on out and meet Adam and I in person. And I think, Adam, you're going to have some free food.
Yeah, it's going to be lunch and everything.
It's going to be
a
good deal. So if you're in the Kansas City area, come on out.
August the 6th, 80th anniversary. Peace through strength for 80 years. That's our effort right there. So, okay, well, thanks to everybody. It was another great episode, and we will see you next time. Oh, yeah, always think deterrence.
There you go.
I forgot about that.
Making me proud, Adam. Make me proud.
Oh, my gosh, we can't take you anywhere.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.